in homes the day of funerals. What happens to a child who doesn't go to a funeral? He gets shunted to his boyfriend or girlfriend's house four doors away, where the television is blaring, and the mother, who obviously doesn't want to intrude upon the way in which you're raising your child and the answers you're giving the child, is absolutely paralyzed from saying anything. And if she has troubles, she may be a lovely woman, but she may have terrible troubles handling death herself. She may tell the child all kinds of nonsense which you're going to have to undo. And the child's away from you. And you're simply building up in that child all kinds of conscious and unconscious fears about funerals and death, which he needn't have. And his nightmares are going to be worse, not easier for him. Now, there's no easy way to handle death. Don't misunderstand what I'm saying. But I'm a firm believer, and I've seen this borne out again and again, that parents should bring the children with them. The parents should not try and avoid telling their children about someone's death. I'm not going to tell Jimmy about his grandfather's death till he comes home from camp. If I've heard that once, I've heard it 100 times. And what happens? Two bunks over, there's another little boy from Cleveland who gets a letter. How did Jimmy take his grandfather's death? And the little boy, in all innocence, runs up to Jimmy and says, "Hey, your grandfather died." And Jimmy hasn't heard about it. And worst, Jimmy knows that in real basic things, he can't trust his parents anymore. They won't tell him things. It's not the way. Bring them with you and bring them along. If there's a cremation, please make sure, just as if there was a funeral, that the urn is there, that the urn is placed somewhere. I don't care how you do it, in a family plot, in a columbarium, but see that there's a place. And finally, keep the yard site for as long as you live. Memories fade. They ought not. Those who've deeply affected our lives are still very much alive to us, and the yard site is one of the ways in which we handle that, one of the ways in which we involve ourselves in that. Now finally, to move from what I think are the basic outlines of a funeral's probably will be handled 5, 10 years from now, what do I see as the major problem which will face us? Because obviously what I've described is not very much different from what exists now. I think the major problems which we face are not in the organization of funerals, but they're going to be in the way in which we accept the lengthening of the period of dying. I think that's the real Achilles heel of this whole problem for us. It's a period which is increasing each year as we learn more and more and how to do more and more medically. It's a period which is painful for the dying and often paralyzing for the living. If I've seen any change in the amount of, in the kind of counseling that I do, it's more and more that I'm dealing with people my age we're trying to come to grips with the complicated emotions that they feel as they watch a parent go into second childhood, the reversal of roles. The complicated emotions they feel as a parent becomes more and more querulous and difficult and insatiable in their demands. The problems which they face as they must deal with their own complex of emotions, which say to them at times, "Goodness, I wish he or she were dead, and I was rid of this problem." Tying up my life, I have no freedom anymore. I can never get away from it. And the reverse kind of problems, I know that I'm a terrible bother to my kids, and I don't want to be, but. Those are terribly human problems. They're basic and hard to handle. Fun an old dog roll once. "Of old, when men lay sick and sorely tried, the doctors gave them physic and they died. But here's a happier age, for now we know both how to make men sick and keep them so." And that's part of our problem. We've lengthened the process of dying, the process of aging and the process of dying. I don't know what to do about it. I do know that it's a strange thing that Once upon a time, parents raised their children, and now they raise their parents. I do know that it falls at a time when the burden falls heavily upon women, just as women are beginning to emerge into the job market in the Middle Ages. Often it's the most frustrating of things that a woman who's all her life looked forward to the time when her children would be raised and she'd be free to work full time, when suddenly there are two or three elderly people and she's the only person who's got to take care of them. Because of course, the burden falls unequally. In our mobile society, even if there are three children in a family, usually only one is in the hometown. The others are scattered through no didn't premeditate this. This is simply the way it happened. The burden falls unequally, and there can be an awful lot of anger, guilt, bitterness build up about it. But I don't know what to do about it. Obviously, the kind of thing that Dr. Poirier's talked about, serene, is a very minor part of the answer, a terminal kind of answer. Obviously, the kind of multiplication of nursing facilities we're seeing in the town and all towns are seeing is part of the answer, but it's only part of the answer. Obviously, we're going to find all kinds of new ways and new kinds of professionals who will be expert in golden age activities, social work, and so on. All that'll be to the good. But somehow or other, we're going to have to find a way to let death be a friend again. And I don't know quite how we do it. There's a midrash which I empathize. I don't know how to take it from the level of theory to the level of practice, but I know I feel with it. The old Jews, Talmudic Jews, had a belief that the Malach HaMavos, the angel of death, couldn't take a human soul as long as the human soul, human being, was engaged in studying Torah, or as long as those around him were engaged in the study of Torah. There was an octogenarian in the second century by the name of Rabbi Joshua, a very fine scholar, great leader, who was beloved by all of his disciples. And he became sick unto death. And he lay on his deathbed. And his disciples gathered around him, and they wouldn't let him die. And how did they do it? By studying Torah. All around his bed, they had their books open, and they were studying Torah. And the Malach HaMavos came and rapped on the window, and there was nothing the Malach HaMavos could do to get in. It's a Talmudic story. It's a great story. And there was in this house an old lady who had been a servant in the house for a whole generation. She loved her master. And she saw this process going on, all done in love, but obviously disaster. The man was in pain. He wanted to die. So what did she do? She went up on the roof of the house. She took one of those great pitchers in which they collected water, and she heaved it over the parapet into the courtyard and landed with a great big bang. And everybody was suddenly startled for a moment, and just there was enough silence for the Malach HaMavos to come in, take the soul, and the soul went. So many say to me, why can't they let me go? I've had enough. I've had my chance. Why can't they let me go? I don't know how to be the nurse, that lady. But I do know that somehow or other, all of us are going to have to find ways to let death be a friend again. And I guess part of the way in which we can do that is to use opportunities such as this 6 weeks talking about death to realize that death need not have the kind of unnatural fears about it we associate with it. That's a phenomenon which is part of life. At the beginning of philosophy, Fran Rosenzweig once said, is the ability to deal with the fact of one's own impending death, and every one of us is death is impending. I begin as I end. Death is part of God's purpose and plan, and hopefully we will plan as intelligently to be partners with Him in that work as we are in the other work of creation. Thank you. As always, the floor is open. Matt. Well, thank you. Come more often. I think we taped it tonight because my handwriting is, unfortunately, it's what got me through college. My professors could never read it. Well, you know, people often say that about my lectures, thank God. But a lecture is a moment. It's a happening. It's what we feel together. And hopefully your children and will have their rabbi or be here with me, and they'll be having this kind of discussion. Because remember this. This is a microcosm of something hopefully, which is hopefully going on in many places in many different ways. It's part of the education of our generation. And I hope it is. Glad you did it here. Half the people there couldn't. I told you what my views are. The question was, how do I relate to Dr. Kubler-Ross's views of life after death? I'm a simple, prosaic fella. And it's not an area that I'll ever argue with anybody on. I can only tell you honestly, as I try and do with everything, where I am. Someday I may change my mind. But, or something may change it for me. I'm not interested in psychic phenomenon, and I'm not interested in, ever really been interested in these kinds of intimations of immortality. I think they're as much wish fulfillment as anything else. Obviously, too, you know, the kind of experience of people who have been brought back is still totally conditioned by the language and the experiences which they had when they were alive. And therefore, they're going to be in terms such as she claims she has found. Gene. Gene has Job's problem. It's the oldest problem in Judaism, Gene. You know, how do we balance out the equity of early death or of untimely death? First of all, the words are interesting. We do untimely says we do the timing. And I don't know. I know that all I know is this, that I was thrust into life. And nothing to say about it. I couldn't say yay, I couldn't say nay. I was. I'm going to be pulled out of life, and I can't say nay. And I long ago decided that there are certain questions that are better not worrying too much about. The rabbis used to say, why does the Bible begin with Bereshit, the B? The B is formed with three lines, one simple above, one line from before and one line below. So the answer the rabbi said was that you shouldn't spend too much time worrying at what's above you, what's below you, or what's behind you. Worry about, you know, your life itself, the text of the Torah. That's a cop-out in one sense. In another sense, it's a profound philosophic statement. Because it says essentially that there are a whole range of problems with which we can't deal. Faith is not the acceptance of what is logical, it's the acceptance of what is illogical, of what goes beyond reason. If we could reason everything out, we wouldn't need faith. And my faith holds on, against all evidence, to some kind of sense of the appropriateness of life. I can't prove it. There's a very real possibility that we're walking on quicksand. That life is simply chaos, anarchy, and confusion, full of sound and fury, you know, signifying nothing. There's a real, very real chance. Faith is his statement, there is meaning, there is purpose, despite everything that Job endures, despite all that evidence. I claim to be, I know you are, a man of faith.
Your early statement, you like the relative to why do we have to think in terms of human beings living on Earth per se in 700 years? We really don't understand the planets yet, and the possibility of the continuation of human beings on those planets.
All right, the first one I can answer, the second, obviously, I can't. I believe that whatever we can do which is useful to those who come behind, we ought to do. But make sure when you will items, your spare parts, to someone else, that number one, you've told your children about it and they agree. Because it's psychologically often very difficult for a child to think of the dismemberment of a parent or someone they love. And unless you've talked it over and explained to them that really it's your will and why, they simply hear a lawyer say, well, your father left this piece of paper. It's awfully very often very hard for them or a husband or a wife, someone close or a mother, to accept it. So if you're going to do it, and I have no problems with you doing it, in fact, I think it's a fine thing to do, make sure everybody understands and agrees with you. And then don't be overly optimistic about how many parts of your body can be used. You know, we're really not as desirable physically as the papers have made us believe that we are. As far as extraterrestrial life, it's again one of those, I used to hear Catholics say to me, we don't have to worry about birth control because we can always shoot people off to other planets. Well, the amount of energy required to shoot people off to other planets, even if we could find something, you know, livable up there, is incredible given the limited resources of the Earth and the limited number of people who fit into one of those multi-billion-dollar spacecraft. We have one Earth. That's all we have. We have no means now available to us to move beyond our solar system. We are prisoners of this solar system, given present technology. There's no reason to assume that we won't be for long periods of time in the future. All of us have over-exaggerated or over-fantasized, I think, the Buck Rogers element of our society. And perhaps outer space is better off without us than with us. They may be able to manage a life, you know, before we pollute it and contaminate it. They may not want us, even if we were able to get there. I'm fascinated, you know, with this UFO business. We think we're threatened by people from outer space. I wonder how much people in outer space think they're threatened by us. In the Jewish tradition, there is no reason for a rabbi to be present at a funeral, period. A funeral is a public occasion where the chesed is given, where the Kaddish is said, or the Il Malei Rachamim and the Kaddish, and however, you know, people want to conduct it. I'm constantly in the business of trying to train other people to put me out of business. In other words, almost everything that a rabbi does is designed by the Jewish tradition to be done by any competent adult. A marriage, funeral, conducting of services, preaching. I have no monopoly on any of those functions. I don't claim it, and I don't really want it. Unfortunately, I become, in a sense, the surrogate for what used to be the ability of, you know, a lot of people in the community to daven, or a lot of people to be Mesader Kiddushin, the organizers of a wedding. Because I'm a professional, I tend to do better than most laymen would if they tried. What I do object to in those conditions, however, is when a funeral becomes something that's not a funeral. I saw in the paper last week that the senior partner of one of the big brokerage houses in New York, Goldman Sachs, died. And he had his burial out of Temple Emanuel in New York, and somehow Nelson Rockefeller gave the chesed. Now, there's something wrong with that, because what had happened in the process was that the family was using this to display its power or its wealth rather than to deal with the human feelings, which hopefully it still existed with the family. I don't know the family at all, so that's not that. But if it can be done in simple terms, in the basic terms, the basic respect, for the needs of the family, by all means.
Well, I'd like to speak just briefly for those of us who were inheritors by a lot of these traditions.
What is Maimonides' tradition? You mean medicine? He was also a pretty good rabbi, so go ahead. We share the tradition.
I think there is a similarity between our callings. I would like to say that no physician in his right mind that I know of is anxious to prevent everyone from dying. It's not our objective. I see my objective, and I think there are others among us that would agree, more as a means of preventing avoidable disabilities and certainly preventing avoidable deaths. Now, you could argue that there are differences between avoidable and untimely. And I think that what this man said is quite right, that there are certainly untimely deaths which can be avoided. We learn from the field. No one really, honestly, thinks that we prevent everybody from dying. The question that comes up one step further is, what about Aunt Sarah being senile? We didn't discover senile senility in our generation. It's been going on for many years. The big problem with elderly people today is the sociological problem. Families, as you said, are separated, houses are smaller, and so on. So that I think some of the problems are not necessarily problems with physicians, they're problems with society. And perhaps we as physicians, rabbis, laymen in general, work together to help solve these. We might find ourselves in some of these positions. But certainly the three score we can, by reading the strange four scores, still trying to figure out.
Well, Mort, you misread me if you felt that I was in any way attacking the medical profession. I wasn't. What I said earlier is that I think it's time to de-romanticize the endless protraction of life. And you happen to be the people who are on that frontier. That all things have to work congruently. You know, many things have to be taken into account whenever you make social change. I think that the problem is not simply that we're facing an explosion of senility, if you will, because that's really what's happening. More people are reaching those ages, and once they reach 75, they've got 8 more years. Once they reach 80, they've got 8 more years. You know, it's remarkable what's happening. And we don't have the institutions as yet, or the trained people, or all the infrastructure that we need to begin to deal with it. We also have a society where we, and this is one of the problems, we are destroying the family at the same time we need for the tail end of life, the family, even more than we've ever needed it before. And no one yet knows how well institutions can take up the slack. By and large, our experience with institutions should make us leery, you know. Thank God they're Jewish institutions, but if you look at the institutions for mental illness, or institutions for delinquent children or all these things, it doesn't give you much hope for what society does when it mass institutionalizes people. Yet how does a modern American home with two people in it, both in their 40s or 50s, both working full time, take care of an 85-year-old parent who's begun to wander? You know, and how many homes can afford, you know, full-time watch help to prevent this person from doing themselves, you know, the kind of harm that they might do, and, you know, and if they did it, imagine the guilt that the kids would feel if it happened. That's what I see. And it's a very real problem. It's happening again and again. Okay, that's all well and good, and, you know, it's the kind of romantic sociological thing that we get in college, but it doesn't work that way, and I've got to deal with the world as it is. What have we done? For second childhood, we've created daycare centers, just as we do for first childhood. We call them golden age centers, but that's exactly what they are, their role is. We find professionals who are equipped to do that role. We are prisoners of an economy where we can't keep people working beyond a certain stage. We've got to provide jobs for the people at the beginning of the lives. Our great problem in our economy is there's no job for the 16, 17, 18, 19-year-old. And unless we integrate into the economy, he's going to create revolution. So somebody has to pay the price, the person who's 30 years and out. And I think it's a little naive, frankly, to say we've got this theoretical problem. It's more than a theoretical problem. We can't talk about the liberation of women and at the same time re-enslave them to their parents, which is in part what you're saying. We can't talk about recreating the family of the 19th century and at the end of the 20th century. It isn't going to happen. We can't delude ourselves as to what institutions are going to be like if we create mass institutions. They're going to be impersonal and badly run and starved for money whenever the society goes into a tailspin. And just as we wouldn't for our lives, if we could possibly avoid it, no parent I know in this congregation will put his child into certain kinds of state institutions, or state institutions, let's say, for the mentally retarded. The same way they do everything they can to not put their parents into state institutions for the aged. That's simply the reality. And I don't know the way around the reality. It's not enough to say, if we only, you know, were this way or that way. We're prisoners of a time. There's a limited range of opportunities open to us. And everything we do means we don't do something else. And I don't think we're going to solve this problem. And that's why I ended with it. I foresee a tremendous amount of heartache and frustration. And I think that in part, the aged are going to have to organize themselves politically to see that they're not taken advantage of. And I think that the middle-aged are going to have to recognize that there's an emotional, psychic price to pay for total liberation. And I think that all of us are going to have to spend a great deal more of our tax money and our private contributions to create 10 Montefiores and Menorah Parks, and 20 Wade Park Manors and whatever they are, and 30, you know, of these. We haven't begun to see the price that's involved. If you would follow my advice, it's a question of if cremated, should a memorial service be after or before? If you follow my advice, there should never be a memorial service. There should be a funeral service, which by definition can be either before or after. If it's before, then I think there ought to be the body ought to be there in a coffin, though the coffin need not be, could be used again. And if it's after, the urn should be there with the ashes. Then they should be placed in some kind of appropriate place. No, I mean there ought not to be a memorial service. Memorial service is, all right, let me define terms. A funeral service precedes interment, precedes cremation. The body is there, or the ash, or I'm using it, the ashes are there, it's obviously after cremation, but there's a sense of the presence of the body. And then you do something with the body. You place it in the earth, you place it in the mausoleum, you place it in a columbarium. A memorial service is a service organized anytime, any place without the body there. And it is something that you see a great deal of among liberal Christians, particularly among Unitarians. You see a good bit of it in the academic community. A group of people come together at some time, 11 o'clock between classes, at the Massastone Chapel, and somebody says something, and then they go back to work. It is not against my version of the Jewish religion. No Orthodox rabbi would give you that answer, however. What about graveside services? Graveside services are fine, provided they don't take place between November and April. I have, and I would say the same thing if we're talking about this, about the new custom, you know, of unveiling a tombstone. You don't never unveil a tombstone, you dedicate a stone. And again, there are no rules. It ought to take place in the summer months. I would hate to have another person die because the unveiling was determined to be in November or December. They got pneumonia at the service. I would hate to suffer, to get sick from it, you know. There's something very selfish in that, too. But a Cleveland winter can be brutal. And for me to have the time, you know, a grave, the interment service itself means that you're out of a car for 4 or 5 minutes at tops in the cold of the winter. But a funeral service at the graveside takes the same 15 minutes. And that's a long time for a 70 or 80 or 90-year-old person or a 48-year-old person to be out in the bitter cold. So just prudence, please. I have no, on theological grounds, I have no objection. If I were in Florida as the rabbi, I would say amen. One more question, and we'll get to Nora. You had, wait a minute, somebody down here had a question. I think that's criminal.
Yes. Then what would, if you believe in a set cremation of an urn or a body, what would be the event? Why have a cremation? Why not go along with the below ground burial?
No reason not to, except that I suspect it's going to become, in time, economically prohibitive, and in a greater time than that, we're not going to have the space to do it.
Well, of course, we have cremations where they can bury it out on the spot, and then it would be a great spot anyway.
Yeah. Norm?
Many of us have been very fortunate to have been to six of these sessions. I want to remind you again that when we started off, this is a pilot program. The fact is we've reached a very small number of our temple congregation. Approximately 100 of us have been here six sessions. We have roughly 1,700 families. We probably have upwards of 3,000 adults in the temple, and probably maybe equal number of children, most college or school age. So you see, we've reached maybe 3% of our adult population and maybe 1.5% of our total population. And a good question can be asked, well, what can we do to reach a larger number of our members? Recognizing some don't want to be reached, and maybe they consider it none of our affair or their affair whether we discuss this matter of death and dying. On the other hand, others may be reached. And what I'd like to ask you to do, either in the privacy of your home, is to take the few moments to fill out these forms or something like it. We don't care how you present the information to us. And what are your thoughts on whether we should try to reach larger numbers? And if so, how? And if you want to take a few moments to raise questions about not so much the content, but an ongoing activity, we can certainly take a few moments now before we have coffee. Does anybody have any thoughts or questions or suggestions on this matter? Yes. Would you stand up, please? Thank you. All right, that's a very interesting observation. You feel that if we did have smaller, more personalized discussion groups, groups of maybe 5 or 10 people they could sit and relate to each other, it might be easier for people to discuss the questions. That's a very good suggestion. Thank you very much. Let me make a note of that one. All right. Any other thoughts? Now, you know, we are going to have a pamphlet. B. Gans has drafted the pamphlet. It's being rewritten and reworked, as these things usually are. The pamphlet will be available on a general basis for our congregation. It's not the first pamphlet. They're already in general usage in most congregations throughout the United States. And one person expressed thought, well, after the pamphlet's in usage, maybe again there might be time to approach our congregation and perhaps go through a similar series, or maybe accepting the suggestion made a moment ago about forming different groups. All right, and we are certainly going to look at that in the fall, I'm sorry, in the spring of the year when this pamphlet is ready. Any more thoughts? Yes, sir. All right, that is, you're taking off what Marianne Levy pointed out, they're doing it. Were you here at that discussion? Jewish Family Service? Yes, that's interesting. You probably independently arrived at the same thought. They have an ongoing group there of widows and widowers who meet, and there's people moving in and moving out of the group, depending on how long they're in the share, the fellowship, and the discussion of the group. And what you're proposing is that perhaps the temple could maintain a similar group of people that are in the grief stage, or in the loss stage. Very good, thank you. Any other suggestions? Yes, sir.
Our in high school for the first year is offering a class, and I don't know whether similar classes are being offered in other schools within the community. Perhaps we could encourage the schools to offer such a class and possibly reach the members of the
Well, we know that. In fact, I think the leaders of that program here, are they here this evening? Yeah. All right. And it's very interesting, by the way, that the two people from Orange School have been here, and they've, I think, learned a lot. And you're both non-Jewish, is that right? Yes, sir. And that's interesting, too. However, I think there's a problem here of the temple trying to expand beyond its borders. I think the feeling of some of us is that, you know, we have a problem within our own temple here, and we should deal with our own congregation. We cannot, you know, solve all the problems. We can't meet all the people. And until we've done a more satisfactory job, and that's, I'm expressing a personal thought here.
Well, I'm here, but my son happens to be a member of the class.
I see.
And I've gotten interested in coming this evening because he is a member of the class.
I see. All right, very good. Any more thoughts? Yes, please.
I want to confirm what he just said. Shaker Heights has had a mini course on that line for four or five years. And I would say my own open acceptance of talking about it in a more comfortable way came from my children taking
very good.
So I
that may, okay, that may suggest something within our religious school and perhaps too then. Our religious school, by the way, can maybe deal with this topic because that's where many of our children are, too, at the same time. All right, very good. Make a note of that one. Yes? Mm-hmm. Okay, make a note of that. All right. Well, very good. Now, please avail yourself of the opportunity to communicate in writing, if you would. And if something does come up in the future, feel free to communicate with the temple, the leadership, either the rabbis or the executive secretary or your officers. And I'm sure you, like I, benefit tremendously by this exposure. And thank you very much.
Congratulations on the well-run series.
Huh? I think we learned something. Okay, well, thank you.
In homes, the day of funerals. What happens to a child who doesn't go to a funeral? He gets shunted to his boyfriend or girlfriend's house four doors away, where the television is blaring, and the mother, who obviously doesn't want to intrude upon the way in which you're raising your child and the answers you're giving the child, is absolutely paralyzed from saying anything. And if she has troubles, she may be a lovely woman, but she may have terrible troubles handling death herself. She may tell the child all kinds of nonsense which you're going to have to undo. And the child's away from you. And you're simply building up in that child all kinds of conscious and unconscious fears about funerals and death, which he needn't have. And his nightmares are going to be worse, not easier for him. Now, there's no easy way to handle death. Don't misunderstand what I'm saying. But I'm a firm believer, and I've seen this borne out again and again, that parents should bring the children with them, that parents should not try and avoid telling their children about someone's death. I'm not going to tell Jimmy about his grandfather's death till he comes home from camp. If I've heard that once, I've heard it 100 times. And what happens? 2 bunks over, there's another little boy from Cleveland who gets a letter. How did Jimmy take his grandfather's death? And the little boy, in all innocence, runs up to Jimmy and says, "Hey, your grandfather died." And Jimmy hasn't heard about it. And worst, Jimmy knows that in real basic things, he can't trust his parents anymore. They won't tell him things. It's not the way. Bring them with you and bring them along. If there's a cremation, please make sure, just as if there was a funeral, that the urn is there, that the urn is placed somewhere. I don't care how you do it, in a family plot, in a columbarium, but see that there's a place. And finally, keep the yard site for as long as you live. Memories fade. They ought not. Those who've deeply affected our lives are still very much alive to us, and the yard site is one of the ways in which we handle that, one of the ways in which we involve ourselves in that. And finally, to move from what I think are the basic outlines of a funeral's probably will be handled 5, 10 years from now, what do I see as the major problem which will face us? Because obviously what I've described is not very much different from what exists now. I think the major problems which we face are not in the organization of funerals, but they're going to be in the way in which we accept the lengthening of the period of dying. I think that's the real Achilles heel of this whole problem for us. It's a period which is increasing each year as we learn more and more and how to do more and more medically. It's a period which is painful for the dying and often paralyzing for the living. If I've seen any change in the amount of, in the kind of counseling that I do, it's more and more that I'm dealing with people my age who are trying to come to grips with the complicated emotions that they feel as they watch a parent go into second childhood, the reversal of roles. The complicated emotions they feel as a parent becomes more and more querulous and difficult and insatiable in their demands. The problems which they face as they must deal with their own complex of emotions, which say to them at times, "Goodness, I wish he or she were dead and I was rid of this problem. Tying up my life. I have no freedom anymore. I can never get away from it." And the reverse kind of problems. I know that I'm a terrible bother to my kids, and I don't want to be, but. Those are terribly human problems. They're basic and hard to handle. Found an old dog roll once. "Of old, when men lay sick and sorely tried, the doctors gave them physic and they died. But here's a happier age. For now we know both how to make men sick and keep them so." And that's part of our problem. We've lengthened the process of dying, the process of aging and the process of dying. I don't know what to do about it. I do know that it's a strange thing that once upon a time parents raised their children and now they raise their parents. I do know that it falls at a time when the burden falls heavily upon women, just as women are beginning to emerge into the job market in the Middle Ages. Often it's the most frustrating of things that a woman who's all her life looked forward to the time when her children would be raised and she'd be free to work full time, when suddenly there are 2 or 3 elderly people and she's the only person who's got to take care of them. Because of first, the burden falls unequally. In our mobile society, even if there are 3 children in a family, usually only one is in the the hometown. The others are scattered through no premeditate this. This is simply the way it happened. The burden falls unequally, and there can be an awful lot of anger, guilt, bitterness build up about it. But I don't know what to do about it. Obviously, the kind of thing that Dr. Porres talked about, serene, is a very minor part of the answer, a terminal kind of answer. Obviously, the kind of multiplication of nursing facilities we're seeing in the town and all towns are seeing is part of the answer. But it's only part of the answer. Obviously, we're going to find all kinds of new ways and new kinds of professionals who will be expert in golden age activities, social work, and so on. All that'll be to the good. But somehow or other, we're going to have to find a way to let death be a friend again. And I don't know quite how we do it. There's a midrash which I empathize. I don't know how to take it from the level of theory to the level of practice, but I know I feel with it. The old Jews, Talmudic Jews, had a belief that the Malach HaMavos, the angel of death, couldn't take a human soul as long as the human soul, the human being, was engaged in studying Torah, or as long as those around him were engaged in the study of Torah. There was an octogenarian in the second century by the name of Rabbi Joshua, a very fine scholar, great leader, who was beloved by all of his disciples, and he became sick unto death. He lay on his deathbed. And his disciples gathered around him, and they wouldn't let him die. And how did they do it? By studying Torah. All around his bed, they had their books open, and they were studying Torah. And the Malach HaMavos came and rapped on the window, and there was nothing the Malach HaMavos could do to get in. It's a Talmudic story. It's a great story. And there was in this house an old lady who had been a servant in the house for a whole generation. She loved her master. And she saw this process going on, all done in love, but obviously disaster. The man was in pain. He wanted to die. So what did she do? She went up on the roof of the house. She took one of those great pitchers in which they collected water, and she heaved it over the parapet into the courtyard and landed with a great big bang. And everybody was suddenly startled for a moment, and just there was enough silence for the Malach HaMavos to come in, take the soul, and the soul went. So many say to me, why can't they let me go? I've had enough. I've had my chance. Why can't they let me go? I don't know how to be the nurse, that lady. But I do know that somehow or other, all of us are going to have to find ways to let death be a friend again. And I guess part of the way in which we can do that is to use opportunities such as this 6 weeks talking about death to realize that death need not have the kind of unnatural fears about it we associate with it. That's a phenomenon which is part of life. At the beginning of philosophy, Fran Rosenzweig once said, is the ability to deal with the fact of one's own impending death, and every one of us is death is impending. I begin as I end. Death is part of God's purpose and plan, and hopefully we will plan as intelligently to be partners with Him in that work as we are in the other work of creation. Thank you. As always, the floor is open. Matt.
I don't know if people can transcribe this or put it in a book. I have rarely been so enlightened.
Well, thank you. Come more often. I think we taped it tonight because my handwriting is, unfortunately, it's what got me through college. My professors could never read it. Well, you know, people often say that about my lectures, thank God, but a lecture is a moment, it's a happening, it's what we feel together, and hopefully your children and will have their rabbi or be here with me, and they'll be having this kind of discussion, because remember this is a microcosm of something hopefully, which is hopefully going on in many places in many different ways. It's part of the education of our generation. and I hope it is. Glad you did it here. Half the people there couldn't. I told you what my views are. The question was, how do I relate to Dr. Kubler-Ross's views of life after death? I'm a simple, prosaic fella. And it's not an area that I'll ever argue with anybody on. I can only tell you honestly, as I try and do with everything, where I am. Someday I may change my mind, or something may change it for me. I'm not interested in psychic phenomenon, and I'm not interested in, ever really been interested in these kinds of intimations of immortality. I think they're as much wish fulfillment as anything else. Obviously, too, you know, the kind of experience of people who have been brought back is still totally conditioned by the language and the experiences which they had when they were alive. And therefore, they're going to be in terms such as she claims she has found. Gene. Gene has Job's problem. It's the oldest problem in Judaism, Gene. You know, how do we balance out the equity of early death or of untimely death? First of all, the words are interesting. We do untimely says we do the timing. And I don't know. I know that all I know is this, that I was thrust into life. And nothing to say about it. I couldn't say yay, I couldn't say nay. I was. I'm going to be pulled out of life, and I can't say nay. And I long ago decided that there are certain questions that are better not worrying too much about. The rabbis used to say, why does the Bible begin with Bereshit, the B? The B is formed with three lines, one simple above, one line from before and one line below. So the answer the rabbi said was that you shouldn't spend too much time worrying at what's above you, what's below you, or what's behind you. Worry about, you know, your life itself, the text of the Torah. That's a cop-out in one sense. In another sense, it's a profound philosophic statement. Because it says essentially that there are a whole range of problems with which we can't deal. Faith is not the acceptance of what is logical, it's the acceptance of what is illogical, of what goes beyond reason. If we could reason everything out, we wouldn't need faith. And my faith holds on, against all evidence, to some kind of sense of the appropriateness of life. I can't prove it. There's a very real possibility that we're walking on quicksand. That life is simply chaos, anarchy, and confusion, full of sound and fury, you know, signifying nothing. There's a very real chance. Faith is his statement, there is meaning, there is purpose, despite everything that Job endures, despite all that evidence. I claim to be, I know you are, a man of faith. All right, the first one I can answer, the second, obviously, I can't. I believe that whatever we can do which is useful to those who come behind, we ought to do. But make sure when you will items, your spare parts, to someone else, that number one, you've told your children about it and they agree. Because it's psychologically often very difficult for a child to think of the dismemberment of a parent or someone they love. And unless you've talked it over and explained to them that really it's your will and why, they simply hear a lawyer say, well, your father left this piece of paper. It's awfully very often very hard for them or a husband or a wife, someone close or a mother, to accept it. So if you're going to do it, and I have no problems with you doing it, in fact, I think it's a fine thing to do, make sure everybody understands and agrees with you. And then don't be overly optimistic about how many parts of your body can be used. You know, we're really not as desirable physically as the papers have made us believe that we are. As far as extraterrestrial life, it's again one of those, I used to hear Catholics say to me, we don't have to worry about birth control because we can always shoot people off to other planets. Well, the amount of energy required to shoot people off to other planets, even if we could find something, you know, livable up there, is incredible given the limited resources of the Earth and the limited number of people who fit into one of those multi-billion-dollar spacecraft. We have one Earth. That's all we have. We have no means now available to us to move beyond our solar system. We are prisoners of this solar system, given present technology. There's no reason to assume that we won't be for long periods of time in the future. All of us have over-exaggerated or over-fantasized, I think, the Buck Rogers element of our society. And perhaps outer space is better off without us than with us. They may be able to manage a life, you know, before we pollute it and contaminate it. They may not want us, even if we were able to get there. I'm fascinated, you know, with this UFO business. We think we're threatened by people from outer space. I wonder how much people in outer space think they're threatened by us. In the Jewish tradition, there is no reason for a rabbi to be present at a funeral, period. A funeral is a public occasion where the chesed is given, where the Kaddish is said, or the Il Malei Rachamim and the Kaddish, and however, you know, people want to conduct it. I'm constantly in the business of trying to train other people to put me out of business. In other words, almost everything that a rabbi does is designed by the Jewish tradition to be done by any competent adult. A marriage, funeral, conducting of services, preaching. I have no monopoly on any of those functions. I don't claim it, and I don't really want it. Unfortunately, I become, in a sense, the surrogate for what used to be the ability of, you know, a lot of people in the community to daven, or a lot of people to be Mesader Kiddushin, the organizers of a wedding. Because I'm a professional, I tend to do better than most laymen would if they tried. What I do object to in those conditions, however, is when a funeral becomes something that's not a funeral. I saw in the paper last week that the senior partner of one of the big brokerage houses in New York, Goldman Sachs, died. And he had his burial out of Temple Emanuel in New York, and somehow Nelson Rockefeller gave the chesed. Now, there's something wrong with that, because what had happened in the process was that the family was using this to display its power or its wealth rather than to deal with the human feelings, which hopefully it still existed with the family. I don't know the family at all, so that's not that. But if it can be done in simple terms, in the basic terms, the basic respect, for the needs of the family, by all means.
Well, I'd like to speak just briefly for those of us who are inheritors of Maimonides' tradition.
What is Maimonides' tradition? You mean medicine?
I hesitate to say as a lay.
He was also a pretty good rabbi, so go ahead. We share the tradition.
No physician in his right mind that I know of is anxious to prevent error. everyone to die. It's not our objective. I see my objective, and I think there are others among us that would agree, more as a means of preventing avoidable disabilities and certainly preventing avoidable deaths. Now, you could argue that there are differences between avoidable and untimely. And I think what this man said is quite right, that there are certainly untimely deaths which can be avoided. We learn from the field. No one really honestly thinks that we prevent everybody from dying. The question that comes up one step further is, what about Aunt Sarah who was senile? We didn't discover senile senility in our generation. It's been going on for many years. The big problem with elderly people today is the sociological problem. Families, as you said, separated, houses are smaller, and so on. So that I think some of the problems are not necessarily problems with individuals, they're problems with society. And perhaps we as physicians, rabbis, laymen in general, work together to help solve these and might find ourselves in some of these positions. But certainly the three score we can, or by reading the strange four scores, still trying to figure out.
Well, Mort, you misread me if you felt that I was in any way attacking the medical profession. I wasn't. What I said earlier is that I think it's time to de-romanticize the endless protraction of life. And you happen to be the people who are on that frontier. That all things have to work congruently. You know, many things have to be taken into account whenever you make social change. I think that the problem is not simply that we're facing an explosion of senility, if you will, because that's really what's happening. More people are reaching those ages, and once they reach 75, they've got 8 more years. Once they reach 80, they've got 8 more years. You know, it's remarkable what's happening. And we don't have the institutions as yet, or the trained people, or all the infrastructure that we need to begin to deal with it. We also have a society where and this is one of the problems, we are destroying the family at the same time we need for the tail end of life, the family, even more than we've ever needed it before. And no one yet knows how well institutions can take up the slack. By and large, our experience with institutions should make us leery, you know. Thank God they're Jewish institutions, but if you look at the institutions for mental illness, institutions for delinquent children or all these things, it doesn't give you much hope for what society does when it mass institutionalizes people. Yet how does a modern American home with two people in it, both in their 40s or 50s, both working full time, take care of an 85-year-old parent who's begun to wander? You know, and how many homes can afford, you know, full-time watch, help, to prevent this person from doing themselves, you know, the kind of harm that they might do, and, you know, and if they did it, imagine the guilt that the kids would feel if it happened. That's what I see. And it's a very real problem. It's happening again and again. Okay, that's all well and good, and you know, it's the kind of romantic sociological thing that we get in college, but it doesn't work that way, and I've got to deal with the world as it is. What have we done? For second childhood, we've created daycare centers, just as we do for first childhood. We call them golden age centers, but that's exactly what they are, their role is. We find professionals who are equipped to do that role. We are prisoners of an economy where we can't keep people working beyond a certain stage. We've got to provide jobs for the people at the beginning of the lives. Our great problem in our economy is there's no job for the 16, 17, 18, 19-year-old. And unless we integrate into the economy, he's going to create revolution. So somebody has to pay the price, the person who's 30 years and out. And I think it's a little naive, frankly, to say we've got this theoretical problem. It's more than a theoretical problem. We can't talk about the liberation of women and at the same time re-enslave them to their parents, which is in part what you're saying. We can't talk about recreating the family of the 19th century at the end of the 20th century. It isn't going to happen. We can't delude ourselves as to what institutions are going to be like if we create mass institutions. They're going to be impersonal and badly run and starved for money whenever the society goes into a tailspin. And just as we wouldn't for our lives, if we could possibly avoid it, no parent I know in this congregation will put his child into certain kinds of state institutions, or state institutions, let's say, for the mentally retarded. The same way they do everything they can to not put their parents into state institutions for the aged. That's simply the reality. And I don't know the way around the reality. It's not enough to say, if we only, you know, were this way or that way. We're prisoners of a time. There's a limited range of opportunities open to us. And everything we do means we don't do something else. And I don't think we're going to solve this problem. And that's why I ended with that. I foresee a tremendous amount of heartache and frustration. And I think that in part, the aged are going to have to organize themselves politically to see that they're not taken advantage of. And I think that the middle-aged are going to have to recognize that there's an emotional, psychic price to pay for total liberation. And I think that all of us are going to have to spend a great deal more of our tax money and our private contributions to create 10 Montefiores and Menorah Parks, and 20 Wade Park Manors and whatever they are, and 30, you know, of these. We haven't begun to see the price that's involved. If you would follow my advice, it's a question of if cremated, should a memorial service be after or before? If you follow my advice, there should never be a memorial service. There should be a funeral service, which by definition is can be either before or after. If it's before, then I think there ought to be the body ought to be there in a coffin, though the coffin need not could be used again. And if it's after, the urn should be there with the ashes. Then they should be placed in some kind of appropriate place. No, I mean there ought not to be a memorial service. Memorial service is, all right, let me define terms. A funeral service precedes interment, precedes cremation. The body is there, or the ash, or I'm using it, the ashes are there, it's obviously after cremation, but there's a sense of the presence of the body. And then you do something with the body. You place it in the earth, you place it in the mausoleum, you place it in a columbarium. A memorial service is a service organized anytime, any place without the body there. And it is something that you see a great deal of among liberal Christians, particularly among Unitarians. You see a good bit of it in the academic community. A group of people come together at some time, 11 o'clock between classes, at the Massastone Chapel, and somebody says something, and then they go back to work. It is not against my version of the Jewish religion. No Orthodox rabbi would give you that answer, however. What about graveside services? Graveside services are fine, provided they don't take place between November and April. I have, and I would say the same thing if we're talking about this, about the new custom, you know, of unveiling a tombstone. You don't never unveil a tombstone, you dedicate a stone. And Again, there are no rules. It ought to take place in the summer months. I would hate to have another person die because the unveiling was determined to be in November and December. They got pneumonia at the service. I would hate to suffer, to get sick from it, you know. There's something very selfish in that, too. But a Cleveland winter can be brutal. And for me to have the time, you know, a grave, the interment service itself means that you're out of a car for 4 or 5 minutes at tops in the cold of the winter. But a funeral service at the graveside takes the same 15 minutes. And that's a long time for a 70 or 80 or 90-year-old person or a 48-year-old person to be out in the bitter cold. So just prudence, please. I have no, on theological grounds, I have no objection. If I were in Florida as the rabbi, I would say amen. One more question, and we'll get to Nora. You had, wait a minute, somebody down here had a question. I think that's criminal.
Yes. Then what would, if you believe in a set cremation of an urn or a body, what would be the event? Why have cremation? Why not go along with the below ground burial?
No reason not to, except that I suspect it's going to become, in time, economically prohibitive, and in a greater time than that, we're not going to have the space to do it.
Well, of course, we do have cremation so they can bury it out on the spot and bring it to the grave anyway.
Yeah. Norm?
Many of us have been very fortunate to have been to six of these sessions. I want to remind you again that when we started off, this is a pilot program. The fact is we've reached a very small number of our temple congregation. Approximately 100 of us have been here six sessions. We have roughly 1,700 families. We probably have upwards of 3,000 adults in the temple, and probably maybe equal number of children, most college or school age. So you see, we've reached maybe 3% of our adult population and maybe 1.5% of our total population. And a good question can be asked, well, what can we do to reach a larger number of our members? Recognizing some don't want to be reached and maybe they consider none of our affair or their affair whether we discuss this matter of death and dying. On the other hand, others may be reached. And what I'd like to ask you to do, either in the privacy of your home, is to take the few moments to fill out these forms or something like it. We don't care how you present the information to us. And what are your thoughts on whether we should try to reach larger numbers? And if so, how? And if you want to take a few moments to raise questions about not so much the content, but an ongoing activity, we can certainly take a few moments now before we have coffee. Does anybody have any thoughts or questions or suggestions on this matter? Yes. Would you stand up, please? Thank you. All right, that's a very interesting observation. You feel that if we did have smaller, more personalized discussion groups, groups of maybe 5 or 10 people they could sit and relate to each other, it might be easier for people to discuss the questions. That's a very good suggestion. Thank you very much. Let me make a note of that one. All right. Any other thoughts? Now, you know, we are going to have a pamphlet. B. Gans has drafted the pamphlet. It's being rewritten and reworked, as these things usually are. The pamphlet will be available on a general basis for our congregation. It's not the first pamphlet. They're already in general usage in most congregations throughout the United States. And one person expressed the thought, well, after the pamphlet's in usage, maybe, again, there might be a time to approach our congregation and perhaps go through a similar series or maybe accepting the suggestion made a moment ago about forming different groups. All right, and we are certainly going to look at that in the fall, I'm sorry, in the spring of the year when this pamphlet is ready. Any more thoughts? Yes, sir.
Perhaps there could be an ongoing program whereby people who have had losses in the past month get together with a person who is willing to
All right, that is, you're taking off what Marianne Levy pointed out, doing it. Were you here at that discussion? Jewish Family Service? Yes, that's interesting. You probably independently arrived at the same thought. They have an ongoing group there of widows and widowers who meet, and there's people moving in and moving out of the group, depending on how long they're in the share, the fellowship, and the discussion of the group. And what you're proposing is that perhaps the temple could maintain a similar group of people that are in the grief stage, or in the loss stage. Very good, thank you. Any other suggestions? Yes, sir.
Our in high school for the first year is offering a class, and I don't know whether similar classes are being offered in other schools within the community. Perhaps we could encourage the schools to offer such a class and possibly reach the members of the congregation through their children.
Well, we know that. In fact, I think the leaders of that program here, are they here this evening? Yeah. All right. And it's very interesting, by the way, that the two people from Orange School have been here, and they've, I think, learned a lot. And you're both non-Jewish, is that right? Yes, sir. And that's interesting, too. However, I think there's a problem here of the temple trying to expand beyond its borders. I think the feeling of some of us is that, you know, we have a problem within our own temple here, and we should deal with our own congregation. We cannot, you know, solve all the problems. We can't meet all the people. And until we've done a more satisfactory job, and that's, I'm expressing a personal thought here.
Well, I'm here, but my son happens to be a member of the class.
I see.
And I've gotten interested in coming this evening because he is a member of the class.
I see. All right, very good. Any more thoughts? Yes, please.
I want to confirm what he just said. Shaker Heights has had a mini course on that design for 4 or 5 years. And I would say my own open acceptance of talking about it in a more comfortable way came from my children taking
very good.
The course. So I
think that may okay, that may suggest something within our religious school and perhaps too then. All right, well, our religious school, by the way, can maybe deal with this topic because that's where many of our children are, too, at the same time. All right, very good. Make a note of that one. Yes? Mm-hmm. Okay, make a note of that. All right. Well, very good. Now, please avail yourself of the opportunity to communicate in writing, if you would. And if something does come up in the future, feel free to communicate with the temple, the leadership, either the rabbis or the executive secretary or your officers. And I'm sure you, like I, benefited tremendously by this exposure. And thank you very much.
Congratulations on the well-run series.
Huh? I think we learned something. Okay, well, thank you.